is toying with him now.
Hey, Caitlin.
Chris, how are you?
Hey, good. It's U.S. Open time, the weirdest U.S. Open ever. Looks very strange. And the whole tournament looks like it's played on a outside court that's like in a remote place that no one cares about the match.
You know, this is the closest to watching professional tennis, even like some of the more minor tournaments and early rounds that I go to.
Yeah.
Sometimes this looks the most like my college tennis experience.
Yeah. Totally.
It's like
totally.
Just no fans.
No
but
fans.
That was because of a lack of popularity, not because of a ban.
Right, right. I think that for some of these matches, like I'm basically acclimated to like the grunting, but on some of these, the squeaking shoes are so loud because there's nothing to cut that sound that I feel like if this happens again, they're going to need a rule.
How do you feel about the noise? Because some people were saying they wish they'd heard piped in fake fan noise. I think it's kind of nuts to hear the emptiness. Like I was watching Serena Williams last night.
Yeah.
And she was making tidy work of her opponent. She looked better in the second round than she did in the first round. But yeah, I could hear her breathing. Like, as a matter of fact, I even turned up the volume so my wife, who was in the kitchen, could hear it. She was like, "What is that sound?" And I was like, "That's breathing." Like,
right. It's breathing.
It was actually really cool to feel like, oh, wow, this is such, it's such an athletic sport, but you usually don't hear anything like that.
It's funny, there's like a weird conversation in the NBA about like whether there's like something wrong with you if you play way better without fans there. it's like someone could have like an improbable run to the semis and like somehow be thought of as like mentally weak or something. I don't know.
It is a really interesting question, though, because I feel like we sort of forget how nationalistic some of these tournaments can be, you know, and like, especially because the Arthur Ashe crowd in particular kind of just draws like general tennis fans. You don't necessarily get partisanship unless you're watching somebody like, you know, like a Coco Gauff or Serena Williams, where it's like so obvious there's a hometown favorite.
Yeah.
But like, it does kind of make you wonder how much that crowd noise really lifts people up, or in the case of Novak Djokovic, provides him like a foil for against which he can create some kind of nexus of power. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. You don't have the like the fun thing with Medvedev last year, where he like kind of became the villain and embraced it so much that people started to hate him less. Like that was kind of nice.
I mean, we've talked about this for years. I wish Djokovic would just lean into the villain status. You know what I mean? Like, just all Medvedev needed to do was like say a few antagonistic things, flip the bird, and then like kind of just laugh it off, and everyone felt like they were in on the joke.
Right.
And now I'm rooting for the guy. You know what I mean?
Right. And it would have been great if he got really specific. If he was like, "Queens, I hate these fucking outer boroughs." Just like really.
Exactly. You bridge and tunnel trash. Right. Manhattan or nothing.
Although,
Djokovic out. Yeah, totally.
I think that would have like almost given respect. That would have been like when people who win the French Open speak French and the crowd is like instantly ready to like vote for them for political office. I think New Yorkers would have been really into that. I was thinking about how this tournament, like in a weird way, I'm like more locked into noticing who's playing because you know, they're like a more personal experience with them. And how some of my favorite players of the tournament are people where I'm like, oh, you're still playing. Like I think you follow it more closely than I do, but like Zvonareva, like, huh,
oh, sure.
Yeah. You were ranked 2 in the world.
she made some Grand Slam finals. I mean, she's a mom. She's like in her mid-30s, if not later.
Right.
And I also think like so much hay was made out of the players who would kind of adhere to the extraordinary circumstances of this tournament.
Yeah.
That everyone who made the choice to do it, and some maybe who are regretting it, like Kristina Mladenovic, for example, which we can talk about if you want to. Like every single person in the tournament feels like you're doing an equation either for them, or you have to assume they are doing it, about whether this was worth it or not. Like somebody like Kristen Flipkins just had like a tweet stream this morning, who's a Belgian player, right, who's kind of known affectionately as Flipper, for example. So Flipper's out. Flipper lost the single, she lost in doubles. And she was part of what is being called the Pair 11. Have you read about this?
I haven't. Wait, no, I haven't.
Oh my God. It's like, sounds like a heist movie, doesn't it? The Pair 11. I feel like somebody should like end up with a bag of cash out from under the bottom of Met Stadium. But instead, it's the 11 players who came into contact with coronavirus positive Benoit Pair and now cannot leave.
Perfect. Perfect.
It's so nuts. Kristina Mladenovic is in that number. Kristen Flipkins is in that number, a whole bunch of French people. So Benoit Paire, I heard some rumors he's been going out and broke the bubble. He's my favorite mess, as you very well know.
He is Typhoid Mary of the tour.
He's the Typhoid Mary. He's patient zero, for all we know. So he was tested positive, and he hung out with, played cards with a bunch of other players, a lot of French people, but including Kristina Mladenovic, but also Kristen Flipkins and presumably others. And basically all 11 of those, whether they're in the tournament or not, cannot get in an airplane until 14 days from their last contact with Benoit Paire passes. And in her case, she was saying this is a real bummer because the next tournament on the schedule for a lot of these players is Rome.
Right.
And even get into Rome, to get to Rome, they have to get situated, practice, get in, qualifying starts. She's not going to be able to play that tournament because she's going to be stuck in Queens at their bubble hotel.
Right.
And because, not even playing, just sitting, chilling out because she is considered to be part of the Pair 11. It's so nuts. This is so nuts. It's crazy.
I mean, like, I feel for them to some degree, and like Rome is meant to be like a beautiful tournament, which would be nice. I feel like if you're one of the people playing cards, like, that's like the like past the time equivalent of like sharing an ice cream cone. Like you're just passing cards back and forth.
Yeah, they're like germ vectors. It does feel like, couldn't you guys like remotely connect to video games? I don't know. I just feel like there's something really truthful based on both this, but also some of the rumors I've heard about how seriously or not some of the players have taken this stuff. Like the rumor was that Francis Tiafoe got sick in Atlanta because he went out to the club. And I have that on good authority that he did. And like, I love Francis Tiafoe. I'm not trying to get on him, but like the individualism and selfishness that you really do have to think of your own actions when you're a tennis player just are perfectly weaponized to not take this seriously and fuck shit up. You know what I mean? Right. Like they could not be less team players because the sport has absolutely nothing to do with considering other people and optimizing your own moments. And I think, right, you'd think that given how little we know about getting COVID and what the lasting repercussions are on your like lungs and smell capabilities and olfactory senses, you'd think that they would be like, oh, well, not me. I'm an elite athlete. I have to like stay in the bubble. But if anything, they're like, I'm invincible. I have like the worst characteristics of a 23-year-old dude. Plus I'm an elite athlete. So I have absolutely no like ownership over any of my decisions. And I'm just going to do whatever the fuck I want. And right. I feel like that's kind of what we've learned from this whole thing.
Right. Like other, everybody else in the world exists to make me better and to make my life work. So like that's, if they get sick, it's like a little bit more like, well, they're not, that's just another thing they're doing to help me.
100%. Like I was actually kind of struck by, I was reading a lot of like celebrity profiles lately. I don't know why, but like, Alex Jung over at Vulture wrote this amazing one about Mariah Carey. And like, she basically is nocturnal. She lives in a mansion and she's got a staff. And her like prime operating hours are between like, as far as I can tell, 3 and 5 a.m. Wow. And so like the schedule of her staff, the schedule of like when her children are kind of like, I don't want to say available to interact with her, but like they clearly are on her same schedule. Can you just imagine creating like a micro sort of experience for yourself where every need is catered to and you have a team and even your family has adjusted their like waking hours to be, to optimize your experience. And I'm not even saying it's bad or wrong. Like Mariah Carey, you know, is probably a lot of things, but she's great at music. And right, like these players are great at playing tennis and they can and are rewarded for creating their own micro like universes. And so it's just crazy to think that like every element of empathy and community and consideration of other people is like, if they can possibly display it, it's because they've had to learn it at a in any way, in every way that's like in conflict with their sport.
Right. Totally. I think that it'll be interesting to see how this goes on. Like, I feel like people will remember this tournament for a while, but like people just forget stuff about tennis because there's so many tournaments and they happen every year. But I feel like if a significant player has to withdraw, not that there is many significant players, but if like Serena or Djokovic or Osaka had to leave, like then it'll be like a more permanent, like, oh, remember when that happened? Than anything else.
Yeah, then can you believe Kristina Mladenovic lost her second round match up 6-1, 5-1 with four match points? I mean, she'll remember that forever.
Right. Yeah, let's talk about that. You wanted to talk about her.
Well, she was sort of interesting because, like, she lost this terrible match, and obviously she was in a really bad mood. But she's one of the pair 11, so now she can't leave, and she's in a bubble within a bubble. So she is not only doing the protocols of the USTA, where it's like you have to stay in one of these two hotels, you're getting tested all the time, but she in particular has been in a micro bubble within that bubble. She can't interact with anyone else inside it. And I guess they have to like practice separately and eat separately. And like, she's basically a pariah now within the world of tennis. She's like, this is terrible. Like, I never should have come. This is atrocious. I feel like I'm a prisoner. And somebody pointed out, well, it's like, well, you're a prisoner who got like 50K for getting into the main draw of the Grand Slam, and you're getting your hotel paid for, so like it's a little different. But I'm kind of sympathetic because it's like, oh man, this lady had a complete mental breakdown, lost to somebody ranked outside the top 100, had four match points, and is now part of this like infamous, you know, scarlet letter group that Benoit Paire, who by the way doesn't seem bothered by this at all, he's like posting photos of himself like on a bike hanging out,
untroubled.
Yeah, untroubled is a great way to describe Benoit Paire. He was the only person right at the height of the pandemic who checked himself into the Cabo San Lucas edition, or maybe it was the Mayan Riviera, but he was like at a sandals resort.
Right,
you're just like, maybe this is safe. But more importantly, the optics of this, like, do you have a team looking at this or what's going on? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, and unbothered is a great way to describe him, which is why I like him as a tennis player, but also I wouldn't put my public's health in his hands.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I feel like they are like a lot of it is going to be like how much their team comes down on them. And so like in a weird way, it might be players that are a little older like him that just feel like they have the freedom to just be a dick about this stuff.
I mean, plus he's French, plus he's like from the Thessaly La Force profile that we ran of him a couple years ago.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think he's like in contention for like Mensa, which, you know, famously like Marion Bartoli is.
Right.
Or like, speaking of Kristina Mladenovic, like speaks 25 languages. Like, I think Benoit Paire is a simple man with simple appetites. And most of them have to do with what Benoit Paire wants to do at that very moment.
So, right.
But, you know, I love talking about him because he's just so extra.
Yeah.
Who else have you been watching? You mentioned Vera Zvonareva. Anybody else that you're kind of like, oh, wow, blast from the past? Or like,
oh yeah, for sure. Gilles Simon. Like, he's been around forever, and also he's the kind of game where he'll could be around forever. Like, he doesn't, his shots, his body is like completely still on shots, and he kind of glides around. I feel like he could be like the next Cole Schreiber or something, who's just, or Tommy Haas, who's just on the tour forever.
Yeah, I mean, no slight to Philip Kohlschreiber, but I don't know that anybody sets out to have their career to be like, oh, you're gonna be like the next Philip Kohlschreiber. But then when all said and done, you're like, oh, Philip Kohlschreiber, like, was in the top 10 for a really long time and top 30 forever. Beautiful one-handed backhand, and, like, he's still making money doing this. So, like, can't be that bad.
And he's also a guy who basically, I think I remember reading, he just has this outrageously bad record against Federer and Nadal and those guys. So, like, it's a little more understandable. Like, he just gets cut down in the fourth round in every tournament because he plays an all-time great, you know? Like, I kind of...
And he's also, like, spanned a lot of all-time greats. Like, I think some of the problems with a lot of these dudes is that they came up during an era where they, like, had no chance
right.
and have just played alongside these guys who are going to cut them down in the fourth round. Whereas if you were starting now, you'd probably lose a lot of like quarterfinal matches to Djokovic and then decreasingly Nadal and Federer. But like in a year or two when they're gone, you'll like only have Djokovic left and you'll kind of have a shot at it. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, if you just had the terrible luck of being the guy who makes fourth round cannon fodder, you know, one would hope that you would not look at your career as being a complete failure, but you also might be like we interviewed Andy Roddick on the podcast with Renee Stubbs, and like Renee asked a really interesting question of him, which is like, do you feel like you overachieved or underachieved? Because I think if you looked at him right after he won the US Open in 2001 and were like, oh shit, this guy's going to make a bunch of Grand Slam finals but not win any other one again.
Right.
It would have been surprising to hear that. At the same time, look, given where my non-existent backhand is, which is something you and I have talked about on this podcast specifically,
right?
And in fact, like, I wasn't even considered like the best tennis player of my family for most of my life.
Yeah.
The fact that I got to like have a Hall of Fame career, raise a Grand Slam trophy over my head, and like have the privilege of playing great five setters against Roger Federer for half of those Grand Slam finals, I feel like I overachieved. And I was like, that's such an awesome way to look at it. Not because it's positive necessarily, but just because like that's, in his mind, like a really good outcome. And I feel like that maybe is more the way we should look at these things, right? Like, it's, you know, athletic prowess and timing are take a lot of the chances out of people's hands.
Totally. I think it was funny the way you were saying that kind of in his voice. Like, I was thinking like, wait a minute, did Caitlin win a major? Did she like win a mixed doubles title in 2003 at the French Open or something? And she's really modest about it.
1 second, I would be modest about that. I would introduce myself to strangers as like, oh, do you mean Grand Slam winner Caitlin Thompson?
Yeah.
You get an honor, like an honorary doctorate.
You would have like a Roland Garros like neck tattoo in clay orange.
100%. I mean, yes. So thank you for seeing me and knowing me.
I think that the last thing that I wanted to talk about is how two of the best moments in the tournament happened after, best or worst, happened after matches, which is Djokovic did the, what you call the boob heave to an empty stadium, which seems like you almost want to worry about his mental health if you're doing that. Like, does he see people that aren't there? It's kind of amazing.
I think, as has long been confirmed, Djokovic is the hero of his own narrative.
Right, right. I mean, if he was doing it like in a tongue-in-cheek way, I guess that's possible. Like, I want to give him, I don't know. And the other one, and we had already talked about this, was the incredible non-handshake at the end of that Sakari match when she... I read something about how part of it was like she was so annoyed with the level of grunting or something, which it might have been something else. But if it was that, that is so 1998. Like, you can't get angry at that anymore. Like, we're past that. But I think she like went up there and they were going to do like a handshake or a racket. And then she did the thing where it's like, you shake someone's hand and then you take your hand back and like run it through your hair like I'm a cool guy. Like, she just totally embarrassed the other woman. It was great.
I mean, I think we're in uncharted territory here, right? Like, both grunting is passe, but also the like non-handshake that we gave players so much shit for. Like, remember when Jeannie Bouchard wouldn't shake someone's hand ahead of a Fed Cup match because she was like, I can't in good faith look at my opponent and wish them well. Because I'm trying to beat them. You're like, oh, okay, but that's not really what that is.
Yeah, so. and it's not like everybody else is like, I love my fellow man. And
I'm really out here to just give this away to my opponent, so I'm going to indicate that by being a good sport. It's like, no, that's not what that is. But now it's a free for all. Some people are tapping rackets. Some people are not doing anything. Some people, in a very endearing move, the players will tap the umpire's toe.
Yeah.
Instead of shaking the umpire's hand, which, you know, usually that's part of the customary routine. I mean, look, as I've said numerous times, I have no marriage to the ways of tennis in terms of our customs, traditions, formats, whatever. The weirder, the better. So I'm not freaked out by being in this brave new world of bubbles and no handshakes. If anything, I hope we take a look at what seems to be working and make the sport more fun.
Right.
Maybe it's like keeping the players mic'd up while they heave. You know, breaths of oxygen, like they do in NFL when you can hear like helmets crunching. Like bring it on. Like, let's make it weird. I like the UTS where all the players were getting nicknames and
having,
you know, giant like air horns. You can do whatever you want to tennis, because to me, tennis is awesome enough that it can sustain multiple iterations. The one thing I don't think it can sustain is like boring continuity. Like, let's make it weird. The players are going to meet the occasion as they have. And you know what? Maybe there's an asterisk to this one because the players are half not there and half complaining when they do show up. But at the end of the day, like, you win 7 matches in Flushing.
Right.
You win the US Open.
Right. No, I mean, if they could split up the broadcast, I think it would be cool if it's being broadcast, say, in France, the other players can curse so long as they're not speaking French. And I mean, just like go crazy. And then the whole world could learn how to curse in other languages.
100%. Lena, I know how to curse in Chinese for reasons I don't get into at the moment. She was cursing up a storm at all of her matches. It was awesome. Anybody wants a crash course on how to get around the streets of Beijing, China, where I lived, listen to a Chinese tennis player play tennis. You'll get it earful. Yeah. Anyway, on that note, I got to run.
Yes.
So let's check in after the Open and see what ended up happening with our bubble in a bubble.